November 5th, and it seems like you go to sleep and you wake up and a new month has happened already. I don't know what's going on here, but this year has gone by in a flash. So, hey, welcome to Earth Ancients. Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia, and I keep telling everybody to check out their website, and they are, as our sponsors, they've created a special page for you, the listener, to check out. And this page is at Gaia.com / Earth Ancients, and it's Gaia, G-A-I-A.com / Earth Ancients. If you go to that page, they have a series of presenters, and it's just one page filled with a few people that are representative of some of the people we have on Earth Ancients, but they have literally hundreds of amazing presentations by people like Graham Hancock, Michael Tellinger, and many, many others. And for 99 cents, for the first month, you jump on that site and you become a member. And then after that, it's about $9. But there's literally hundreds of amazing presentations, features, pyramid complex information, consciousness expansion, physical body work like yoga and Tai Chi. So check it out. That, you know, they're sponsoring us. They keep us going, and we need you to keep working with them. So Gaia, it's www.gaia.com/Earth Ancients. Hey, you know, our country is shifting, and it's shifting to the point where it's becoming really fun to go out and have a meal. And what I mean by that is, the other day I was with a friend and we were driving along, and he's saying, you know, I'm starving, we got to get something to eat. And I'm saying, you know, fine, let's go stop somewhere. We couldn't stop because we had to keep driving. We had to go down south. It was going to take us some time. And he said, well, have you heard about Carl Jr.? And I said, well, no, Carl's Jr. is a fast food place. I'm not going there. I can't eat that stuff. He goes, no, they have a new burger. They have a burger that has grass-fed, no hormone, no antibiotic beef. And I was like, no, you're kidding me. You can't get that. And we pulled in to Carl's Jr., and this is not a promo for Carl's Jr. This is just a kind of an idea of what's shifting. And we got one of these burgers, and my God, it was really good. And it's amazing that this is happening, and I'm really happy about it, because for the most part, when you have commercially produced beef, it's from an animal that's been injected with all kinds of growth hormones, antibiotics, been, you know, tortured in the commercial cattle ranches. And it's a shift that I would like to see in a larger scale. Now, I'm not endorsing fast food, McDonald's and stuff like that. Although I have to admit that in my day as a kid, I had my, you know, McDonald's burgers, and like us all, you know, that was kind of fun to go there. But, you know, the older you get, the more conscious you are of your food. And I don't eat a lot of beef. I don't eat a lot of meat as a whole, but sometimes you got to have a burger. To see this change is mind blowing. And I hope it grows and grows. And I applaud Carl's Jr. because I got to have a burger once in a while. And burgers, you know, burgers and beer, burgers and a Coke, or burgers and water. So Carl's Jr., wow, pretty amazing. Hey, this week on the Facebook page, we have some amazing things to look at. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago about this new technology, this 3D technology that is in cameras. And not all cameras have 3D focus, but I've posted three different images that are taken of the main Giza plateau. And these are 3D photographs. In other words, they're also 360, the 360 degree images that are shot in 3D. So what that says is that the image comes out of your monitor to a degree well, it's not like complete 3D, but they call it 3D, and they also say 360. But there's three images. One is what I call the megalithic highway, where an image has been taken with a drone, one of these remote-controlled drones that flew up above the Great Pyramid of Cheops. And this is one of the most amazing photographs you'll ever see, because it's above the pyramid looking down, and you can move the, with your mouse, you can move the image completely around in a circle. So you're looking above, and you can actually see the magnificently large size of these pyramids. And it's the actual images in between two pyramids. That's the first image I want to talk about. The second one is right next to the great Cheops pyramid, which is the largest pyramid in the world. And this image is a 360 of that, but it also allows you to pan up into the depths of the pyramid, which is amazing. That's number two. And then there's the Queen Hatshepsut mortuary temple, which is just this magnificently large temple. And you're looking at it from the entranceway, and the person is holding this camera is doing a complete walk around in a circle. So you see the statues as you enter, you see the walkway, you see the columns, and you see the depth, the sophistication of this temple. And you can see all of those photographs, all three, on our Facebook page. So just go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to the group page, and you'll see all three of these photographs. You know, for those of us who don't travel or can't get over there, this technology is really going to make it fun to see these ancient sites that I talk about each week. And, hey, what better way to do it than sit in the comfort of your home and, you know, and your laptop and take a look at the details of these ancient sites. And these cameras are so sophisticated. You can see the dust on the pyramid blocks. You can see the sand at your feet. It's quite amazing. And it's the first step technology. So check it out. And I'm going to keep posting these photographs as they come to me, and as I find out where people are traveling. We're going to be in Mexico in April, and I've mentioned this, and I am going to have somebody with a drone with me as we travel, so we'll have some photographs. I don't know the level of the cost of one of these cameras, but someone told me the other day that there's certain regular phones that can have an app added to them that gives them this ability. I can't really believe that, because my thought is that it has to have a lens of some kind to be able to capture these details. But hey, if it's that simple, I might do it. So stay tuned for that. And remember, Path of the Sacred Maya, that's the trip, April 2nd through the 8th. We're going to be in Mérida, Mexico. I just started pulling out some of my books from my last trip to Yucatan. And I've also discovered this, which makes this trip quite fascinating, is each time I go there, and I go there like once every, I used to go there once every couple of years, but it's been like 6 years since I was in the Yucatan. Every time I go, a new pile of rocks, which is what basically is a building, has been excavated and consolidated. And we're going to be going to Mayapan. We're going to go to the Maya University, Chichen Itza, Ekbalam, which has these amazing figurines all around the entrance of the main pyramid. We're going to Kabah and the glorious Uxmal, which has the only oval pyramid in the whole world. We'll be going there again in April, early first week of April. And I only have a few places left. And this is going to be an eye-opening tour for not only me, but I think those of us, those of you who can come with me. And if you want to take one of the last seats, send me an email, send it to cliff@earthancients.com, and I will send you that information. And I think you're going to really enjoy the trip. It's not that expensive. Flights to Mexico are cheap. But my feeling is that this part of Mexico, this part of the world, is really the focal point for a truly ancient civilization. As you know, my belief and the belief of a lot of the authors and research investigators on this program believe that the Maya are descendants of a much earlier, very ancient civilization. And we know that because the building of pyramids, a pyramid complex, is very, very sophisticated mathematics, geometry, sacred geometry, and actually construction, because these things are huge. They weigh a ton, and not only that, they are elegant to look at.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And here we go. We're back at Australia again. This time they've discovered a 50,000-year-old Aboriginal settlement. And this is unique because they've found the bones of extinct gigantic wombat eggs from giant birds, obviously human bones. And what makes it unique is it shows that there was sophisticated settlements long, long time ago. They thought it was about 40,000 years is what was the estimate. But now, 50,000 years ago, sophisticated settlements in Australia, to the point where they were forming groups and just amazing to check out. I have the entire article. You can look at the title is Man Searching for Toilet Stumbles Across 49,000-plus-year-old Evidence of Earliest Human Settlements in Australia. Apparently, a guy was looking to relieve himself, and he walked into a cave, and there, behold, were petroglyphs. There were artifacts, and he was out in the outback. And, oh, my God, did he find a treasure trove of material. So you can see that on the Earth Ancients page. Go to Earth Ancients Facebook, go to the group page, and you can read all about it. Pretty amazing, pretty fantastic. And we constantly are getting these information about very early man, very sophisticated man, that are kind of rewriting the history books. Very interesting stuff. So we're going to come back home today, and we all know about the Statue of Liberty. It's the most famous monument, most famous recognized monument in the United States. I know for a fact my great-grandfather came to America from Germany, and he didn't actually take the boat, but he did land in New York. he did talk about to my grandfather his impressions of the Statue of Liberty. And what we do know is Bartoli, the French sculptor, sculpted this magnificent piece, and it was actually built by Gustave Eiffel of the famous Eiffel Tower, and is considered a neoclassical sculpture, which was it was actually dedicated in 1886. But there's a lot more to this gift to us from the French people. And our guests today have actually done a tremendous amount of research into this magnificent sculpture. And they've written a book called The Secret Life of Lady Liberty, Goddess in the New World. We have with us today Bob Hieronymus, and we also have Laura Kortner, who have written this book. Bob is an internationally known historian, visual artist, and radio host. He is the host of a weekly program called 21st Century Radio, and he's written a number of articles and books. Laura has co-authored books with Robert, including The Founding Fathers, Secret Societies, and United Symbolism of America. And they're both coming to us today from the East Coast. How are you, everybody?
Hi, Cliff. Thanks for having us.
Well, this is we've been looking forward to this interview for a long time, really. This is pretty exciting. The stuff that you're doing on your show is just extraordinary. It is, you know, when I first started in 88, we had nothing like this, nothing like what you were doing, and it's fantastic.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's kind of fun. We have fun.
I want to go to Mexico with you.
Only a few seeds left.
Sounds like fun.
Hey, yeah. You know, this is a wonderful book. I think before we came on, I was mentioning that the press release I got just doesn't do it justice. You have taken this amazing monument and really drilled into not only the symbology, but what it means to us on so many different levels. I think I want to start by asking you, Bob, what was it that brought you to consider a book on the Statue of Liberty? What was it about the actual statue that would impress you enough to take on this? You know, I mean, writing a book is not an easy thing to do. I don't care what you say. It's just something that, you know, you just don't close your eyes and it, I mean, comes through. It just takes a lot of work. What was the impetus in creating this book?
Well, the impetus had a lot to do with the mis and disinformation that was coming out by the extreme right, especially in denouncing the Statue of Liberty, of calling it the Whore of Babylon, of doing everything it could to dismiss it, and finally they came to a conclusion that it should be torn down and a cross be put up instead. And this irritated me to no end, certainly same to Laura, because hearing this propaganda from the right just tore my heart to pieces. And there is it's so easy to cut something down when you haven't done any research. You know, when you take a look at any good book, take a look at its bibliography. Take a look at the kind of people that these people depended on to get to the bottom of the research. And it was always, every time I checked it out, none of the sources that most of these far to the right were using were adequate sources. They were not scholars. They were not people that spent so much time, decades, like we have done in this book. We have 17 pages of a bibliography, Cliff, and they are some of the leading thinkers in their fields, all the way from Dr. Elaine Pagels to Elaine Eisler, et cetera. Mm-hmm. All of these individuals are individuals that have put such knowledge out there whose shoulders we stood on in order to get to our conclusions. So the initial reason why we had to do it, we had to correct, especially, as you know, I've done a lot of history channels, a lot of discovery channels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, you're never able on these channels to give the other side. You're always pushed to present your material, and you're never in there to debate. And I always felt that was pretty bad, especially with the Statue of Liberty and what they were calling her. So it was, to me, something that had to be done because they were destroying the major symbol of our country and the world. The Statue of Liberty is not only found in America. They are now in China. There are Statue of Liberties around the world. Every state has a Statue of Liberty in it in the United States. You'd expect that, but not in China and elsewhere.
Yeah. So well, let me ask you this, Bob. Let me ask you. Now, the Statue of Liberty stands for liberty. I mean, there's been movies written about it when people come in, during the big exodus from Europe during war and before that, they would see the Liberty and say, this means that I am looking at a country that recognizes me individually and maybe culturally. But when you say that there's other liberty statues of liberty or similar liberties, does it have a certain meaning that you can give us that isn't known? Is it an unconscious meaning of the goddess? Or can you tell us a little bit about your
personal
feelings?
Well, I'll jump
feelings?
In here if you don't mind. I think the people
Please.
Have the reaction they do, especially the immigrants coming to this country, when they see the Statue of Liberty for the first time, mm-hmm. has to do with the connection to the goddess, whether it's conscious or unconscious. I think that mm-hmm. humanity thirsts for that mother goddess that we have not just suppressed in our Judeo-Christian traditions, but demonized. And that's what Bob was alluding to. We were getting so fed up with these conspiracy theories that are not based on history at all. They just see some connecting similarities in symbolism, and they make giant leaps, and they put out a lot of bad history. And our academic friends will challenge us on this. Why are you even paying attention to them? They're obviously based on nothing. They just circular reasoning. They quote each other. And they call her names, and as he said, they just want to push instead their Christian version of their Christian religion. But the Statue of Liberty is a goddess. She's based on the Roman goddess Libertas, and
right.
that's one of the reasons she resonates so much with the not just the American public, with the international public. She stands for enlightenment through liberty and a law-based liberty. That was the intentions of its creator, who was Edward de La Boulaye. He doesn't get a lot of credit in the history of the Statue of Liberty, but he was the legal scholar who was behind the idea to create a statue as a gift from the French people to the American people, and it was his idea to make it of la liberté. They already had the image of the female goddess in France, as well as they had it in England. Different versions, of course. You call her Marianne in France, and there's a Britannia version in England. But the idea that came through in 1886 when it was unveiled, it took a long time, but it has gradually worked its way into the consciousness of the world as the symbol of the best that America can be, as you say, the country where we're supposed to have the right to believe whatever we want to believe, the liberty to choose.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Do you think that Bartholdi had an intent in the actual composition of this wonderful statue to express the goddess? Was it his intention? Did he do research into the composition, the spiked, not the spike, but the helmet that she wears.
The raven and the crown. Yeah.
Yeah.
The raven and crown.
I mean, there's a lot of subtlety that we don't talk about.
It was done deliberately to inspire French people. I think that's the twist that people in America, now that she's our girl, forget. You know, it was designed by French people for French people. There's this overlay that we've given her that she was designed for a gift to the Americans. But it was really La Boulaye and his group, of which Bartholdi was a member, they were pro-Republic and they were pro-American. And the French history, I'm sure you know, since the French Revolution has gone through ups and downs. It went pretty much every 20 years. They had a revolution, they had anarchy, they had royalty, and then they tried a republic again. So this was around 1840, 1850, 1860, after the Civil War. La Boulaye and his friends said, well, let's really push this time. We're going to try to get a republic. We want to emulate the United States. Let's give them a gift to show them that not all of France had supported the South in the Civil War, as the emperor had done, and show that we really we want to rally the French people to create the Second Republic. And it actually worked. They were also surrounded with images of the goddess. I don't think they thought of it in terms of goddess worship as we are in our look at it as a deeper symbolic meaning. To them, it was more metaphor. You know, women had been allegorized for centuries because of the Latin version of those words are feminine. So you've got liberty as a female, you've got justice as a female, so on and so forth. And they had that, the French seal, the seal of the French Republic that was created right around that time, looks almost exactly like the Statue of Liberty. So he didn't make that up out of thin air. He was using what they already had. They have these robed females, and then we have a long chapter in our book about whether or not they're robed, clothed, or if their breasts are showing, and what that means as far as whether they were a radical anarchist or if they were the law-abiding type that La Boulaye liked. So that's why the Statue of Liberty is fully clothed, which has all kinds of repercussions as well. But it was because it was a conservative icon.
You know, the Statue of Liberty, you know, myths, symbols, and archetypes are are more than just sources of historical knowledge of the objective world. Their symbols are also significant forces in the psyche. Symbols are a bridge between the conscious and unconscious mind. They cultivate wholeness, and that results in self-realization. You're talking like Carl Jung here, because when a symbol contains both the conscious and unconscious elements, it can relate to the entire psychic system, and it can be assimilated in consciousness relatively quickly. And from the standpoint of humanistic and transpersonal psychology, of which that's what my degrees are in, my doctoral degrees are, and we have lost symbolic mythological systems in this country because they have been attacked ferociously by the extreme right. Whereas you take the reverse of the Great Seal of the United States, you know, the pyramid with the eye and a triangle, it's having a heyday of negativity, dealing once again with individuals who don't really know its history and say it is satanic. So symbols are really a key to our consciousness and our well-being, as Rollo May and Jung and all the other guys said, and all the women in this area. But the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of balance. And when you take a look at its separate symbols, you can see how it is balanced. It's kind of right-left hemisphere type of thing here in a right hand. What she got? She's got a torch. This torch is related to higher consciousness. It's related to the elevation of awareness. It is the light. It's not a fire to start revolutions. Mm-hmm. It is really enlightenment, period. And its left hand is cradling this tablet of July 4th, 1776. The left hand, the feminine hand, the feminine dealing with, especially nurturing, caring for. It's like her child. Her child is like the birth of this country. It's her baby. And then you take a look at the crown that's on her head. This crown is on her head because it is balance. She is balanced. We have a lack of balance in this country. We have a lack of balance in the world today. And it's become a serious, serious problem where it's tearing our nation apart and it's tearing other nations apart. And there is an important symbol. And that symbol is, you can't see it. Can you guess what it is? For $30,000. That's quite. The chain. The chain that once upon a time was held in her hand is under her foot. And that chain under her foot is about slavery and chains that bind us to the material world, basically saying there is more to life than the physical world. What a story to be told in this enlightened being of the Statue of Liberty. And to see her destroyed by extremists who feel that women are secondary and men, a patriarchy, are tops. That's what has destroyed parts of our nation today, and you can see it in our election system. I'm sorry to go on so long.
Yeah, no. In fact, you are bringing up a lot of issues that I have personally with this presidential election that we're dealing with right now. And without naming names, the Republican side, to my mind, has had issues with not only women's health controversies, but so many other issues. And it's been tough. And I can hear it in your voice that you're passionate about what this statue stands for. And maybe what you're saying in so many words is that this politician, this presidential race has brought up a lot of questions about what we stand for as a nation. And here's the biggest symbol of all, this amazing statue
of a powerful woman, you know. The denigration of the goddess and the suppression of women's rights go hand in hand. The same people that attack the Statue of Liberty or the other Statue of Liberty that's big in our country, the one that's on top of the U.S. Capitol Dome, she's technically called the Statue of Freedom, but it's another depiction of Lady Liberty. She's armed, actually. That's her official name is Armed Liberty, because she's got Minerva's cap and a big old eagle on her head. But in any case, the people that say that that is evil are the same people that say that women should be put back in their place and should not have the right to choose when and how often they have children and should not have the right to have that control and quality medical care. And there's a pushback from the feminist movement that has had successfully legislated and gotten women's rights. We're still not protected under the U.S. Constitution. Women can still be discriminated against, and a new administration coming in at any time can wipe out all the legislative advances that women have made in this country. That's why the ERA is still a valid concern, and it's still being fought for, because women do not have equal rights protected in the U.S. Constitution.
If we eliminate the ERA and do not have it in our Constitution that women are equal, they can change the laws. All you need is 60-some percent. Then you can reverse all of the great changes that have come upon in our culture in recent years. And it really, obviously, it scares me a great deal. But just like you, I'm a fighter for the truth. And you have to stick your neck out when it gets to this point. I mean, one of the great things about your show are the ancient cultures. And when you begin to understand how, when you talk about ancient cultures, we're going back 50,000, 60,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And when you take a look at, you know, do you mind if I get into this a little bit? Well,
a little
I'm
bit.
Go to it.
I want to take a look at the face of the goddess.
Of course. Take a look at the face of the goddess. What is she? Is she male or female? Take a very close look in our book in the pictures. You'll see that she is a combination of both. She is both male and female. And because of that, that sets me back to the research that was done in the work of Dr. Rudolf Steiner and Helen Blavatsky going back to ancient cultures, in which they said there was a time when we human beings were not just male and female, we were both. We were Hermes, Aphrodite. We were both, and that there was a separation of sexes tens of millions of years ago in which we divided ourselves into the male active outside external world and the female, the internal intuitive world. And we are those things. I'm like 51% male and maybe 49% female. I don't want to offend you, but I believe in reincarnation. And I believe we flip back and forth learning how to treat other people. Learning the golden rule is really the key to everything. I know how corny that sounds, but it is.
Yeah.
It's how you treat people. You know, it's
right.
As far as I'm concerned, it's a very simple game. Prayer is speaking to the divinity.
Well, let me ask you, Bob. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
This statue obviously represents the goddess. And in your book, you say the goddess in the new world being America, United States of America. But what do you see as a researcher that is important to recognize as the ancient goddess in this statue?
Well, it connects us to... I believe that there are other dimensions of consciousness. I believe that the ancients knew about those dimensions, and we are discovering ancient cultures which connect us to those archetypes and which affect our ideas concerning we as people. My view is basically that we will eventually discover we are all interconnected. We are not separate from one another. And eventually, we will evolve into, as they said in Woodstock, we are one people. We are earth people. And, of course, I don't find a problem out there being other types of beings on this planet that aren't necessarily from this earth. So as far as I'm seeing is that archetypes are healthy. The Statue of Liberty is a significant archetype for the rest of the world, which indicates that peace is inevitable over long... We got a long way to go, but we can get there. We got big problems in front of us the way ancient cultures did. They had problems. Atlantis had problems. I think we're going to be moving towards the kind of problems that some of them that they have. We're being flooded time and time again. We're being told that the Earth by the Native Americans who basically took a look at our changing culture as Mother Earth is about had it.
I would like to say partnership is the reason that we really focus on the Statue of Liberty as a goddess. What was really revealing to me in doing this book, we thought we were going to do a very simple book, you know, just outlining the tablet and the the Crown of Rays and the Torch and maybe go into the Indian Princess and the Indian Queen. But the publisher is the one that suggested we look at her as a goddess in the New World. They were the ones that came up with that concept. And that forced us to go way back in history to the Neolithic and the goddess-worshipping cultures and the work of Maria Gimbutas and Rhian Eisler. And we learned and learned and learned and read one book after another and tried to look at her as a goddess. And what I learned, anyway, from doing that research is that the cultures, the indigenous cultures today who still worship the goddess or the earth as one, are more partnership-oriented. And those who see the divine in female and male form as partners also treat their women as partners. So there's not that hierarchy domination top-down type of thing that we've been living under for the past 5,000 years or so since that cultural shift happened. And in learning the history of the Statue of Liberty, we learned the history of suppressed women who were just as effective and important to not just the building of this nation, but obviously throughout history. We have an appendix in our book about women you should have learned about in school. We've got it posted on our website, secretlifeofladyliberty.com, along with a lot of the illustrations Bob was just referring to. And so that's what we really want to focus our attention on, is the fact that Americans identify with this symbol as the symbol of us. It's our mother goddess, even though we don't really consciously address it as that. That's why we have felt so strongly connected to her, a lot of other reasons as well, practical ones that make that statue work so well, where it's placed and how it's simple in design and those kind of things. But, you know, the fact that she is a goddess should open up to other readers more about the goddess cultures and therefore, hopefully, transition us all more towards that partnership balance. You know, we're all half-half, male-female, and, you know, there's no reason to be pushing one sex over the other.
Well, let me ask you, you produced, and of course Bob was the host of this Lady Liberty Radio, which was an interview series that you guys did, I guess it's on the 21st Century Radio, but you did this for a number of years and interviewed tons of people. That must be, I mean, that's why this book is so amazing and so diverse, but it must have left you with just so much and just such an opinion of this statue than what most people consider it. If you had a takeaway, of course, there's so many takeaways from your radio program. Is there like two or three points that are critical in understanding the symbology of this statue? Because, I mean, I can see it, freedom and the goddess, which is women. But is there anything else that you can bring to light on that?
Well, first I'll admit that the Lady Liberty radio series was a practical decision, because when we realized that we had to learn so much, we just didn't have enough time to add all that reading in with the weekly reading that we already do to prepare for our interview show. So we developed a series, and we started inviting them onto our radio show so that we could work them in to the already ridiculous amount of reading that we have to do. I would go for the action in her official title. The official title of the Statue of Liberty is Liberty Enlightening the World. And that reminds us that taking action to be educated and enlightened, you know, those both are the keys to maintaining a Republican society where ideally we're all considered equal under the law, because that was big for La Boulaye. That's why she's holding that tablet of law. It can't be an unrestrained liberty of anarchists, and he was terribly afraid of that. He lived through that enough himself, where you go too far to the left and there's just no control at all. So it has to be a moderately conservative version of liberty equal under the law. So I would go for that, as far as other than the partnership and the balance of the need for women to become leaders. You know, she's a representative of a very strong, balanced woman, but she's enlightening through education. And I think the first thing that women in an underprivileged countries do when they're educated is they seek out birth control, because they know controlling the number of children is key to their poverty, overcoming poverty, and rising up out of just animal existence. So that's true for both a family and higher up on the nation state, and then, of course, to world in general.
Well,
interesting.
I used to be one of those individuals that believed in patriarchy, and I was shocked out of it only by being asked one time by an individual who was running for the mayor of the city of Baltimore. He asked me to do his poster. I decided, okay, I do it if you allow me to say what I want to say, which was, this is, we're moving towards the dawn of a new era, a new consciousness. And some would like to call it the age of Aquarius, but we haven't quite got there yet. He said, okay, do what you want, because he was going up against an individual who was involved with organized crime. And I felt for sure enlightenment was really needed in this. He did the poster. He won the election by a landslide. And then I said to him, look, how have you become so successful? What is the key to it? And he said, surround yourself with intelligent women. They can work out things dealing with compromise that men do not do. And we've seen that history. The Nobel Prizes have been given out to women a few years back who did that when and this was in Africa. The males were ready to go to war forever. They were not going to compromise. It's kind of like our Congress was for a while. And it was a group of women that locked them behind doors and said, you're not coming out here until you get to a solution to this. And they did. And it made a world the difference. Same thing happened in our Senate a few years back. I forgot, was it 2013 or so? Yeah, 2013, when the women got together and had their pizza, Republicans and Democrat women got together and worked out methods by which the only legislation that was passed during that year was through the women. I think that's a great story, and I think it is effective, and we need that today. It's true that women will compromise on important issues, not negative compromise, but give and take. Men see that as almost like a football game. You got to win no matter what. Well, if you do that, you could destroy the world. And with the talk of today that it's okay by some people running for office, that perhaps maybe a nuclear war can be won. Reminds me of the time of Bertrand Russell. Remember Bertrand Russell and Band the Bomb?
Sure. Yeah.
Well, he was a god of mine back in the old days. So it took that personal political experience that changed me forever when I realized what a fool I was to think that men were always smarter than women. You know, when you listen to radio back in the 40s and the 50s, it was always this anti-fight against men and women, and women were forever put down in these game shows in which they would lose because they weren't well enough educated.
Right, you were just brought up that way. That's the way you were, and I was brought up in the 70s to believe that the women's movement was over because women could do whatever they wanted to. You know, even Barbie became an astronaut. So it was, it took me till this book to realize that I had to still claim to be a feminist because there's still a long way to go. Now, what Bob is talking about, women and men, it's stereotypical, of course. They're not all like that, and there's just as warlike women and just as compassionate men out there. But they do technically approach problem solving differently, and that's where we get into the Indian princess in that chapter that we talk about, the League of the Iroquois in particular, because they influenced our founders in the revolutionary generation so much.
Let me ask you about that, because that's a really interesting point and something that we talk about on my show and this show here, which is the native consciousness. And when we speak of the native consciousness, we talk about their reverence for the earth and how they, through thousands of years of discipline and understanding that the earth gives quite a bit and you need to be in touch with the earth, how does that relate to Lady Liberty? How does that energy, that consciousness, how is that imbued in this statue? I'm really curious on that.
Well, we do enter into that through this concept called the Indian princess, which was a European, of course, devised image, and it looks like more of a European woman dressed up as an Indian. She was something that was used by the revolutionary generation, Paul Revere, Ben Franklin in particular, when they were still in the the idea stage of the revolution, when they were still kind of coming to grips with the idea that they might have to break away from the mother country. They still considered themselves Englishmen living abroad, so to speak. And they had the image of Britannia, who was way back from the Roman occupation of Britain, who was based on... It looks a little bit like Minerva. She's got a shield, but the English people were interested in liberty. You know, they had their own glorious revolution long before the American Revolution, and they were liberty loving. You know, compared to their French neighbors, and so Britannia started taking on aspects of libertas. She started carrying the pole and the cap, which are the identifying symbols of Libertas, the goddess of the freed slaves. So this was starting to come over to the colonial people, and they were even more English than the English in that regard. They were more liberty-loving. You know, the English people coming over to America would comment that the children were just out of control, and they even gave their women rifles. You know, they were just much more open. And so they needed a new identity, and they created this Indian princess who was sort of a younger sister of Britannia. She's a rebellious teenage daughter, so to speak. She also carries the pole and the cap, but she's wearing a tobacco leaf skirt, and she has feathers in her hair, and she is called America. And that was what they used to rally the populace to this idea that they could break away and become Americans. It was the first time they called themselves Americans. Up until then, it was just the Native Americans who were called Americans. So okay. It's true that there was a great deal of influence. They even invited the Iroquois leaders to the debates over the Declaration of Independence. They were sleeping upstairs on the second floor throughout all of June and July, and, you know, just there to observe and learn. And you can just trace through the influence theory is what this is called. Just trace through all the writings of the leaders of the revolution. Ben Franklin, John Adams, you know, were creating a government of modern-day Indians. They were very consciously borrowing the best that the great law of peace had given them. Of course, they did not borrow the counsel of the clan mothers. They left that out either deliberately or unconsciously. They just couldn't see it. They just did not conceive that women should be considered on par. You know, we have this phrase in our book, "Where are your women?" That came from a Cherokee leader when they were going to negotiate peace.
I read
and
that.
They were
that
just
was
shocked.
Quite interesting. Yeah.
How could you not bring your women to this council? How can you make any decisions for peace and war without your women counselors? Because that's what they had relied on. Because they knew inherently that women and men approach problem solving differently, and women are less likely to go to war, whether or not it's because they're the carriers of the next generation and they know how much pain and trouble as goes into giving birth, that they're not as eager to send those children off to war. Who knows why? There's different hormones in play, and we talk about the hormone, the role of the hormone oxytocin, and how it's absorbed differently amongst women.
Yeah, that's key.
Right.
Yeah, and that could play a part. You know, oxytocin is produced equally in men and women, and we don't really know exactly how it's used, but it's also used not just in birthing and in breastfeeding, that's when it's released, but it's also used to calm and in stressful situations. And women apparently have more access to this hormone in times of stress, which is why they should be around your peace negotiation table, because they're more likely to stay calm and circle together and try to find a solution, whereas, as Bob was saying, men are more likely to demand to have their voice heard and have their way. So, yeah, the Council of the Clan Mothers, when you look at the comparison in the chart, would be on par with the Supreme Court. They didn't make any decisions particularly about war and peace without the women. You know, the women elected the men. The men were the speakers in public, but the women behind the scenes basically were the ones telling them what to say.
Yeah. Bob, what do you say about the Native influence on this and its importance? Because I personally really take in this wisdom. You know, traditional Native wisdom is one thing, but just kind of a cultural wisdom. What do you say about that?
Well, I've been saying for a long time, but I could never get the history of the national, any of those shows. I mean, I've done dozens of them. They would never allow me to talk about the League of the Iroquois.
Not sexy enough.
They just don't want to hear about it because they haven't done the research. 1142 A.D., there were representative forms of government in America by the Native Americans, League of the Iroquois, Cherokee, and many others, because in their women were especially, because of their monthly cycle, were supposed to and were put in stayed in a cave, and they spent all of their time during that period of 3 or 4 days, maybe a week, meditating. This developed an activation of their internal intuitive being. Meditation is key. I started to mention prayer was important, but so is meditation. But even more important than prayer and meditation is service. Service to others. That's what the oxytocin does within all human beings. You don't look at the negative side or feel negatively towards other beings, living beings. You feel in harmony with them. It creates harmony and balance. So that's why the founding fathers paid attention to them. And in my book, I wrote it back there in 1988, and in my doctoral thesis. But unfortunately, it is not popular. And I don't know if we can ever get a media that is so hell-bent on patriarchy, to begin to accept it. It's the media is heavily biased. I mean, I'm so frustrated in that, and never being able to, I really pleaded the case for it for years until I just gave up. I won't do any more of those shows. Because as far as I'm concerned, I'm wasting my energy and time because the real key here is working together. And working together means higher consciousness, working towards higher consciousness. How do you establish that kind of peace of mind? Well, as I said to the boredom of most people, prayer, talking to the divinity, listening to the divinity is meditation, and then that's not enough. What you need to do is start to take care of things on the outside with other people. We are headed towards some great disasters in this world, not just in this country. The floods, the fires have been underestimated. Now, fortunately, I hope Exxon will be charged in court, especially the New York State, for all of the money they have been giving to the extreme left so that... Well, it's important. If the extreme left needed and worked with the Koch brothers.
You're talking about the extreme right.
Extreme right.
The left side's good, isn't it?
Well, not if it's extreme. It could be just as radical.
Well, not
extreme, and you know,
course,
the media is biased because it's consumer culture driven. They're trying to get us to become materialistic consumers because that's what pays their bills.
Yeah.
And that's what drives their programming. And that's where you get the conflict with the goddess, because if you study the goddess, especially the Native American traditions, you realize that you have to have respect for the earth. And you have to work together with each other. It's all partnership and reciprocity and respect and giving back, because they would never take from the earth without giving back to the earth. And that's what we learned so much from the Native American traditions that, of course, as soon as the revolution was won, we disavowed all of that, and the Indian princess herself as a symbol was very quickly cloaked in the Greek and Roman robes, and you know the her skin grew paler and paler just very quickly by about the War of 1812 period. We were no longer pretending to be Indians. That was very popular up until then. You know, they had all these little societies of Indian, the Society of the Red Men. Of course, no Indians, Native Americans would have been allowed to join, but they were very much emulating the Native Americans until they got into control and they realized that they weren't unable to hold the settlers back, and all the treaties that they ever made were broken. And so therefore they had to, the Indian princess disappeared. She became, until around the 1876, the centennial, the mythological Indian princess was reborn through the myths of Pocahontas and Sacagawea, and they were, you know, good Indians were the ones that converted to Christianity or married white. You know, those were, what she fell into. The Indian princess became the symbol on a tonic bottle or something, you know, peering out from the past.
You know, there are recent stories that are being broken by the BBC and Princeton at this time that basically state America is no longer a democracy but an oligarchy. And I think they hit the nail right on the head. As a matter of fact, I did a mural at Johns Hopkins University in 1968 which told that story. It had the Statue of Liberty going down in flames. It had floods coming in, mainly because at that particular time I had two good friends, one Christopher Bird, Secret Life of Plants, And Peter Tompkins, Secrets of the Great Pyramid, Christopher Bird was the best man at my wedding. We were buddies until, of course, we lost him. But they were OSS and CIA. And they came to me, and they shared with me what they found out about what was going on.
Back in 1968.
That was 1971, 72. Mm-hmm. And they shared with me what they knew the CIA thought was going to happen. First, they said, we will be talking about global warming. But that's not the real problem. The real problem is global cooling, moving towards an ice age, that the global warming will and somehow trigger global cold, and that CIA had to make a choice to go to the American people and tell them it's either cooling, which we could do something about relatively quickly, but global cooling we couldn't, because these are periodic changes in our climate over a period of time. We have hastened on up those changes so that we are not ready. We're not ready going to handle this. And there's so much that has been done corporately, especially by Exxon funding these groups that say there's no big problem. You don't have to worry about it. It reminds me of Noah's Ark. Remember Noah's Ark, in which everyone laughed at Noah saying, well, we're going to have big floods here. And that was a big joke. People didn't pay attention. Well, now
you're talking
you
about Exxon funding people speaking about the global warming issue.
Yeah, climate change deniers.
Yes, climate change deniers.
Okay, okay.
Yes, that's what's being considered right now in many states, especially in New York. New York is going to press them because there's enough documentation of this. They have been giving millions of dollars, ExxonMobil, but they're not the only company, that fuel company that's doing that. But they basically did. You know how the Tea Party was put together? It wasn't put together by a group of people that felt, hey, we needed some real changes in America. It was put together by the Koch brothers and the tobacco companies, because they learned how the tobacco companies taught us how you can get around and keep from being destroyed by how to deny it. And if you get corporate money all the time, you control the media. The media is not going to tell your story. The media has done a poor job in educating people in America as what's coming on. And that's probably one of the reasons why we've continued to work on 21st Century Radio. It may be even to you one of the most important things about what happened to ancient civilizations. How did they disappear? Is it periodic, like many of the researchers have said? I mean, now I'm our dear friend, Dr. Robert Schock. Robert, we broke that story in 1992. He first came on 21st Century Radio and said, Bob, no one's paying attention to this. And I said, well, we will. And we did.
Are you talking about the redating of the Great Sphinx?
Yes,
yes,
the,
of course.
The
of course. Yeah, we've had both Robert and John Anthony West.
Name?
John was just on the program.
West. Yeah, he's been on. Yeah.
You know, they were great leaders, and they still work together, but he's working with other individuals now because he used to be very skeptical of all of this. He is a great geologist. He's a great scientist.
He's a thinker.
Mm-hmm. A superior thinker. And he's got a wonderful wife partner that is really a compliment to him and his work, keeping him balanced and focused on these important discoveries against the Egyptologists back there in the early 90s. I'm not going to name the names here. I'm not sure you know them. Was heroic. He knew that he was outnumbered. He knew they were going to lie about him and diminish
him. His work has shifted. His work and John Anthony West and people like Graham Hancock, their work has shifted the perception of the public. And that shift has changed the attitudes of the traditional academics and making them think twice about their decisions to date to chronicle, to actually chronicle how things happened in the past. They're still steadfast, but when you have such overwhelming evidence of a geological change, especially in the weathering of the Sphinx, it proves right there that they have to rethink their whole history. But the thing that's even more amazing about that whole unveiling is it makes us rethink history. And that's where I'm fascinated, and my listeners are fascinated about what is the story of the ancient history. Listen, in the time we have left, I want to ask you each to comment on this statement. Lady Liberty is a personifies America and its destiny. How does it do that? Tell me, Bob, we'll start with you. What is the personification that you see in this statue? And what is the future? What does it say about the future of America?
It says that those of us, if we are our civilization is to continue, need balance. And that's balancing our inner and outer. And we will do it. We can succeed and do it. Other human beings have done it in the past. And ancient cultures certainly did it. So my opinion is that in the decades, well, hundreds of years from now, it may take us that long to make the big changes in our consciousness so that we don't continue to destroy our Earth.
And okay. I would add to us, the Statue of Liberty is the goddess of the new world, you know, not the concept that we think of new world versus old world, which is rather derogatory to the Native Americans who were here already and much older, in fact, but a new world, you know, a newly re-envisioned world that implies and incorporates the Native American wisdom, because it's clear that the balance that was built into the Iroquois system anyway for such a long term of peace, it was the voice of the clan mothers. And when we studied the family tree of the Statue of Liberty, we recognized that that's the essential ingredient for balance is missing from the U.S. government still to this day is the voice of our own clan mothers. And that liberty, the concept, it's a huge concept, can be accepted in a female form. It reveals to me, anyway, that the female form is powerful enough to contain such a big and universal force. It's the so-called women's strengths of nurturing, caregiving, life-giving. Instead of encouraging women to be strong like men, we should be encouraging both to respect what each brings to the table. Much more can be achieved in every endeavor when both halves of humanity work and unitedly to cultivate each other's strengths and grow together. That's what we hope that you can see in the Statue of Liberty from now on.
Amen.
That's fantastic. I want to just ask Bob, let me ask you this last question. This election, this presidential election has revealed a real discourse in American society. I have been surprised at the anger and the kind of loss of just consciousness for not only for the Earth, but just for so much.
Stability.
What? I mean, what happened? Where did we go off on this? It seems there's a massive population that's just unbalanced.
Well, it's partly imbalanced because, I hate to go back to this, the media kept it from us. The media would not pay attention to the individuals that are making such a big noise now. And because of that, the anger that was developed, especially when you had back there, when Clinton was president, you had, what were the two? There? Oh, I'm trying to think of the two significant attacks
like
on
Waco
and Ruby Ridge. You know, what was done in Waco was out and out murder, and the Christian fundamentalists saw that. Is that how Hillary is going to be? Because the person that was our attorney general at that time was really a misfit, and unfortunately, the New York Times did the best articles and basically saying there was nothing. They really weren't doing that much wrong down in that time period. They did not have to come in with the tanks. It was, I think that Hillary, as being like an Athena warrior, I'll tell you, I'm voting for her only because I could never tolerate a Trump. He is going to destroy or would destroy what's left of unity, and then you will see a split in the United States turning into several different countries. That's my great fear because they are powerful enough to do it, especially in Texas. Texas has been wanting to do this for decades, and they have the, you know, and they got the money down there through their oil and everything like that. That's going to be a, we're going to face that soon. As a matter of fact, and individuals that I know that, that have checked into the future and this using remote viewing have seen our nation divided into several different nations. I don't want to see this, and I hope they're wrong. But if they keep moving, this, whatever happens in this election, it's not over. It won't be over.
Yeah,
they will continue to fight and divide. And they've got a lot of wealthy people who are on their sides because the corporate power is in total control. The billionaires are in control.
Interesting. The book is called The Secret Life of Lady Liberty, Goddess in the New World. Thank you both for joining me. You can get this book on Amazon now. I saw it the other day. What is your website so people can go
and,
to?
And Barnes & Noble, don't forget them.
Oh, Barnes & Noble,
they're
still around.
Them. SecretLifeOfLadyLiberty.com, and we do have gallery of 100 images, or more than 100 actually, of the evolution of the symbol and some of the political things that we get into as well.
I'm most proud of all those illustrations, and there are more. There are hundreds more on our website. Mm-hmm. It's something that's most unusual.
I'll put that up on the Facebook page. People who want to see more, I will have it up, and also some excerpts, some photographs from this wonderful book. All right. Well, hey, more power to you. I like the idea. We didn't have enough time to really get into this massive book. I really suggest that our listeners get a copy and have a chance to look at it. So thank you both. It was wonderful.
Thank you. Now let's go to Carl's Jr. and have a humane hamburger. I love that.
Can you believe that? Boy, I was surprised. Maybe that's a trend. I hope so.
It's a little bit at a time.
You know, that was a big problem when I used to travel with rock and roll groups because we didn't have any place to go. Jimi Hendrix would have loved that. Yeah. He really would have.
All right.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. All right. Hey, you. Thanks again. We'll talk to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. So Secret Lives of a Lady Liberty, fascinating book. We just touched the surface, I'm going to put up some photos and a website that you can check on. As a reminder, our guest next week is Xavian Hayes, and we've had Xavian on before. He has written an amazing book on his research on giants in ancient America. And these are people that are 8 feet tall or larger. We've had quite a few individuals on the program who spoke about the mounds, the various mounds that are found throughout eastern United States. But he has found some amazing information that relates to the Spanish conquistadors who traveled throughout Northern America before Columbus, and have found quite a bit of information that he has featured in this book. So stay tuned. Giants of Ancient America, that's next week's on the program. As always, this show is sponsored by Gaia, and they are presenting a whole new series on a number of authors here on Earth Ancients. You can get this new program by going to gaia.com/Earth Ancients, and it's Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. Go to that website. You'll see a whole special page of full-length programs by a number of our presenters, by a number of authors, well-known researchers, authors, and academics who are talking about ancient America, ancient Earth, Earth Ancients. I hope you'll check that out. Supports our program and keeps us going. Okay, that's it for today, and we'll talk to you next time.